quests, adventures, towers, worlds to win?" Eddie said and smiled wanly. Neither of them turned as fresh tear gas rounds flew through the windows to explode, hissing, on the floor. The first acrid tendrils of the gas were now slipping into Balazar's office.
"Sounds better than one of those Edgar Rice Burroughs books about Mars Henry used to read me sometimes when we were kids. You only left out one thing."
"What's that?"
"The beautiful bare-breasted girls."
The gunslinger smiled. "On the way to the Dark Tower," he said, "anything is possible." Another shudder racked Eddie's body. He raised Henry's head, kissed one cool, ash-colored cheek, and laid the gore-streaked relic gently aside. He got to his feet.
"Okay," he said. "I didn't have anything else planned for tonight anyway."
"Take these," Roland said, and shoved the clothes at him. "Put on your shoes, if nothing else. You've cut your feet." On the sidewalk outside, two cops wearing plexiglass faceplates, flak jackets, and Kevlar vests smashed in the Leaning Tower's front door. In the bathroom, Eddie, dressed in his underpants, his Adidas sneakers, and nothing else, handed the sample packages of Keflex to Roland one by one, and Roland put them into the pockets of Eddie's jeans. When they were all safely stowed, Roland slid his right arm around Eddie's neck again, and Eddie gripped Roland's left hand again. The door was suddenly there, a rectangle of darkness. Eddie felt the wind from that other world blow his sweaty hair back from his forehead. He heard the waves rolling up that stony beach. He smelled the tang of sour sea salt. And in spite of everything, all his pain and sorrow, he suddenly wanted to see this tower of which Roland spoke. He wanted to see it very much. And with Henry dead, what was there in this world for him? Their parents were dead, and there hadn't been a steady girl since he got heavily into the smack 3 years ago. Just a steady parade of sluts, needlers, and nosers, none of them straight. Fuck that action. They stepped through, Eddie actually leading a little. On the other side, he was suddenly racked with fresh shudders and agonizing muscle cramps, the first symptoms of serious heroin withdrawal. And with them, he also had the first alarmed second thoughts.
"Wait!" he shouted. "I want to go back for a minute. His desk! His desk, or the other office! The skag! If they were keeping Henry dope, there's got to be junk! Heroin! I need it! I need it!"
He looked pleadingly at Roland, but the gunslinger's face was stony. "That part of your life is over, Eddie," he said. He reached out with his left hand.
"No!" Eddie screamed, clawing at him. "No, you don't get it, man! I need it! I need it!"
He might as well have been clawing stone. The gunslinger swept the door shut. It made a dull clapping sound that bespoke utter finality and fell backward onto the sand. A little dust puffed up from its edges. There was nothing behind the door, and now no word written upon it. This particular portal between the worlds had closed forever.
"No!"
Eddie screamed. And the gull screamed back at him as if in jeering contempt. The lobstrosities asked him questions, perhaps suggesting he could hear them a little better if he were to come a little closer. And Eddie fell over on his side, crying and shuddering and jerking with cramps. "Your need will pass," the gunslinger said, and managed to get one of the sample packets out of the pocket of Eddie's jeans, which were so like his own. Again he could read some of these letters, but not all. Chieflet, the word looked like. Chieflet. Medicine from that other world. "Kill or cure," Roland murmured, and dry-swallowed two of the capsules. Then he took the other three Astin and lay next to Eddie, and took him in his arms as well as he could. And after some difficult time, both of them slept. Shuffle. The time following that night was broken time for Roland, time that didn't really exist as time at all. What he remembered was only a series of images, moments, conversation without context, images flashing past like one-eyed jacks and treys and nines and the bloody black bitch queen of spiders in a card sharp's rapid shuffle. Later on, he asked Eddie how long that time lasted, but Eddie didn't know either.
Time had been destroyed for both of them. There is no time in hell, and each of them was in his own private hell. Roland, the hell of fever and infection. Eddie, the hell of withdrawal.
It was less than a week, Eddie said. That's all I know for sure.
How do you know that?
A week's worth of pills was all I had to give you. After that, you were going to have to do the one thing or the other on your own.
Get well or die.
Right.
Shuffle. There's a gunshot as twilight draws down to dark. A dry crack impinging on the inevitable and ineluctable sound of the breakers dying on the desolate beach. Kablam! He smells a whiff of gunpowder. Trouble, the gunslinger thinks weakly, and gropes for revolvers that aren't there. Oh, no. It's the end. It's... But there's no more. As something starts to smell... Shuffle. Good in the dark. Something, after all this long, dark, dry time, something is cooking. It's not just the smell. He can hear the snap and pop of twigs, can see the faint orange flicker of a campfire. Sometimes when the sea breeze gusts, he smells fragrant smoke as well as that mouth-watering other smell. Food, he thinks. My God, am I hungry? If I'm hungry, maybe I'm getting well. Eddie, he tries to say, but his voice is all gone. His throat hurts. Hurts so bad. We should have brought some Astin, too, he thinks, and then tries to laugh. All the drugs for him, none for Eddie. Eddie appears. He's got a tin plate, one the gunslinger would know anywhere. It came, after all, from his own purse. On it are steaming chunks of whitish-pink meat. What? He tries to ask, and nothing comes out but a squeaky little farting sound. Eddie reads the shape of his lips.
I don't know, he says crossly. All I know is it didn't kill me. Eat it, damn you.
He sees Eddie is very pale. Eddie is shaking, and he smells something coming from Eddie that is either shit or death, and he knows Eddie is in a bad way. He reaches out a groping hand, wanting to give comfort. Eddie strikes it away.
I'll feed you, he says crossly. Fucked if I know why. I ought to kill you. I would if I didn't think that if you could get through into my world once, maybe you could do it again.
Eddie looks around.
And if it wasn't that I'd be alone, except for them.
He looks back at Roland, and a fit of shuddering runs through him. It is so fierce that he almost spills the chunks of meat on the tin plate. At last it passes.
Eat, goddamn you!
The gunslinger eats. The meat is more than not bad. The meat is delicious. He manages three pieces, and then everything blurs into a new... shuffle. Effort to speak, but all he can do is whisper. The cup of Eddie's ear is pressed against his lips, except every now and then it shudders away as Eddie goes through one of his spasms. He says it again.
North. Up. Up the beach. How do you know? Just know, he whispers.
Eddie looks at him.
You're crazy, he says.
The gunslinger smiles and tries to black out, but Eddie slaps him hard. Roland's blue eyes fly open, and for a moment they are so alive and electric, Eddie looks uneasy. Then his lips draw back in a smile that is mostly snarl.
Yeah, you can drone off, he said, but first you gotta take your dope. It's time.
Son says it is anyway.
I guess. I was never no Boy Scout, so I don't know for sure. But I guess it's close enough for government work. Open wide, Roland. Open wide for Dr. Eddie, you kidnapping fuck.
The gunslinger opens his mouth like a baby for the breast. Eddie puts two of the pills in his mouth and then slops fresh water carelessly into Roland's mouth. Roland guesses it must be from a hill stream somewhere to the east. It might be poison. Eddie wouldn't know fair water from foul. On the other hand, Eddie seems fine himself, and there's really no choice, is there? No. He swallows, coughs, and nearly strangles while Eddie looks at him indifferently. Roland reaches for him. Eddie tries to draw away. The gunslinger's bullshooter eyes command him. Roland draws him close, so close he can smell the stink of Eddie's sickness and Eddie can smell the stink of his. The combination sickens and compels them both.
"Only two choices here," Roland whispers. "Don't know how it is in your world, but only two choices here. Stand and maybe live, or die on your knees with your head down and the stink of your own armpits in your nose. Nothing," he hacks out a cough, "nothing to me."
"Who are you?"
Eddie screams at him.
"Your destiny, Eddie," the gunslinger whispers.
"Why don't you just eat shit and die?" Eddie asks him.
The gunslinger tries to speak, but before he can, he floats off as the cards shuffle. Kablam! Roland opens his eyes on a billion stars wheeling through the blackness, then closes them again. He doesn't know what's going on, but he thinks everything's okay. The deck's still moving, the cards still shuffle. More of the sweet, tasty chunks of meat. He feels better. Eddie looks better, too, but he also looks worried.
"They're getting closer," he says. "They may be ugly, but they ain't completely stupid. They know what I've been doing. Somehow they know, and they don't dig it. Every night they get a little closer. It might be smart to move on when daybreak comes, if you can. Or it might be the last daybreak we ever see."
"What?" This is not exactly a whisper, but a husk somewhere between a whisper and real speech.
"Them," Eddie says, and gestures toward the beach. "Datachek, Dumachum, and all that shit. I think they're like us, Roland, all for eating, but not too big on getting eaten."
Suddenly, in an utter blast of horror, Roland realizes what the whitish pink chunks of meat Eddie has been feeding him have been. He cannot speak. Revulsion robs him of what little voice he has managed to get back. But Eddie sees everything he wants to say on his face.
"What did you think I was doing?" he nearly snarls. "Calling Red Lobster for takeout?"
"They're poison," Roland whispers.
That's why you're hors de combat. What I'm trying to keep you from being, Roland, my friend, is hors d'oeuvres as well. As far as poison goes, rattlesnakes are poison, but people eat them. Rattlesnake tastes real good, like chicken. I read that somewhere. They look like lobsters to me, so I decided to take a chance. What else were we going to eat? Dirt? I shot one of the fuckers and cooked the living Christ out of it. There wasn't anything else. And actually, they taste pretty good. I've been shooting one a night, just after the sun starts to go down. They're not real lively until it gets completely dark. I never saw you turning the stuff down."
Eddie smiles.
"I like to think maybe I got one of the ones that ate Jack. I like to think I'm eating that dink. It, like, eases my mind, you know?"
"One of them ate part of me, too," the gunslinger husks out. "Two fingers, one toe."
"That's also cool." Eddie keeps smiling. His face is pallid, shark-like. But some of that ill look has gone now, and the smell of shit and death, which has hung around him like a shroud, seems to be going away.
"Fuck yourself," the gunslinger husks.
"Roland shows a flash of spirit," Eddie cries. "Maybe you ain't gonna die after all. Darling, I think that's marvelous."
"Live," Roland says.
The husk has become a whisper again. The fish hooks are returning to his throat.
"Yeah?"
Eddie looks at him, then nods and answers his own question.
"Yeah, I think you mean to. Once I thought you were going, and once I thought you were gone. Now it looks like you're gonna get better. The antibiotics are helping, I guess. But mostly I think you're hauling yourself up. What for? Why the fuck do you keep trying so hard to keep alive on this scuzzy beach?"
"Tower," he mouths, because now he can't even manage a husk.
"You and your fucking tower," Eddie says, starts to turn away, and then turns back surprised as Roland's hand clamps on his arm like a manacle.
They look into each other's eyes, and Eddie says,
"All right. All right."
"North," the gunslinger mouths. "North, I told you." Has he told him that? He thinks so, but it's lost. Lost in the shuffle.
"How do you know?"
Eddie screams at him in sudden frustration. He raises his fists as if to strike Roland, then lowers them. I just know. So why do you waste my time and energy asking me foolish questions? He wants to reply. But before he can, the cards shuffle. Being dragged along, bounced and bumped, his head lolling helplessly from one side to the other, bound to some kind of a weird travois by his own gun belts, and he can hear Eddie Dean singing a song which is so weirdly familiar he at first believes this must be a delirium dream. Hey Jude, don't make it bad, take a sad song and make it better. Where did you hear that? He wants to ask. Did you hear me singing it, Eddie? And where are we? But before he can ask anything, shuffle. Court would bash the kid's head in if he saw that contraption, Roland thinks, looking at the travois upon which he has spent the day, and laughs. It isn't much of a laugh. It sounds like one of those waves dropping its load of stones on the beach. He doesn't know how far they have come, but it's far enough for Eddie to be totally bushed. He's sitting on a rock in the lengthening light, with one of the gunslinger's revolvers in his lap and a half-full waterskin to one side. There's a small bulge in his shirt pocket. These are the bullets from the back of the gun belts, the diminishing supply of good bullets. Eddie has tied these up in a piece of his own shirt. The main reason the supply of good bullets is diminishing so fast is because one of every four or five has also turned out to be a dud. Eddie, who has been nearly dozing, now looks up. What are you laughing about? He asks. The gunslinger waves a dismissive hand and shakes his head. Because he's wrong, he realizes. Court wouldn't bash Eddie for the travois, even though it was an odd, lame-looking thing. Roland thinks it might even be possible that Court might grunt some word of compliment, such a rarity that the boy to whom it happened hardly ever knew how to respond. He was left gaping like a fish just pulled from a cook's barrel. The main supports were two cottonwood branches of approximately the same length and thickness. A blowdown, the gunslinger presumed. He'd use smaller branches as supports, attaching them to the support poles with a crazy conglomeration of stuff. Gun belts, the glue string that had held the devil powder to his chest, even the rawhide thong from the gunslinger's hat, and his, Eddie's, own sneaker laces. He had laid the gunslinger's bedroll over the supports. Court would not have struck him, because sick as he was, Eddie had at least done more than squat on his hunkers and bewail his fate. He had made something, had tried. And Court might have offered one of his abrupt, almost grudging compliments, because crazy as the thing looked, it worked. The long tracks stretching back down the beach to a point where they seemed to come together at the rim of perspective proved that. "You see any of them?" Eddie asks. The sun is going down, beating an orange path across the water, and so the gunslinger reckons he has been out better than 6 hours this time. He feels stronger. He sits up and looks down to the water. Neither the beach nor the land sweeping to the western slope of the mountains have changed much. He can see small variations of landscape and detritus, a dead seagull, for instance, lying in a little heap of blowing feathers on the sand, about 20 yards to the left and 30 or so closer to the water. But these aside, they might as well be right where they started. No, the gunslinger says. Then, yes, there's one. He points. Eddie squints, then nods. As the sun sinks lower and the orange track begins to look more and more like blood, the first of the lobstrosities come tumbling out of the waves and begin crawling up the beach. Two of them race clumsily toward the dead gull. The winner pounces on it, rips it open, and begins to stuff the rotting remains into its maw.
"Did it, chick?" it asks.
"Domachum," responds the loser.
"Dada kablam!"
Roland's gun puts an end to the second creature's questions. Eddie walks down to it and grabs it by the back, keeping a wary eye on its fellow as he does so. The other offers no trouble, however. It is busy with the gull. Eddie brings his kill back. It is still twitching, raising and lowering its claws, but soon enough it stops moving. The tail arches one final time, then simply drops instead of flexing downward. The boxer's claws hang limp.
"Dinner will soon be served, master," Eddie says.
You have your choice, fillet of creepy crawler or fillet of creepy crawler. Which strikes your fancy, master?
I don't understand you, the gunslinger said.
Sure you do, Eddie said. You just don't have any sense of humor. What happened to it?
Shot off in one war or another, I guess. Eddie smiles at that.
You look and sound a little more alive tonight, Roland.
I am, I think.
Well, maybe you could even walk for a while tomorrow. I'll tell you very frankly, my friend, dragging you is the pits and the shits.
I'll try.
You do that.
You look a little better, too, Roland ventures. His voice cracks on the last two words like the voice of a young boy. If I don't stop talking soon, he thought, I won't be able to talk at all again.
I guess I'll live. He looks at Roland expressionlessly. You'll never know how close it was a couple of times, though. Once I took one of your guns and put it against my head, cocked it, held it there for a while, and then took it away. Eased a hammer down and shoved it back in your holster. Another night I had a convulsion. I think that was the second night, but I'm not sure. He shakes his head and says something the gunslinger both does and doesn't understand. Michigan seems like a dream to me now. Although his voice is down to that husky murmur again, and he knows he shouldn't be talking at all, the gunslinger has to know one thing.
What stopped you from pulling the trigger?
Well, this is the only pair of pants I've got, Eddie says. At the last second, I thought that if I pulled the trigger, and it was one of those dud shells, I'd never get up the guts to do it again. And once you shit your pants, you gotta wash 'em right away or live with the stink forever. Henry told me that. He said he learned it in Nam. And since it was nighttime, and Lester the Lobster was out, not to mention all his friends...
But the gunslinger is laughing, laughing hard, although only an occasional cracked sound actually escapes his lips. Smiling a little himself, Eddie says, I think maybe you only got your sense of humor shot off up to the elbow in that war. He gets up, meaning to go up the slope to where there will be fuel for a fire, Roland supposes. Wait, he whispers, and Eddie looks at him. Why, really?
I guess... because you needed me. If I'd killed myself, you would have died. Later on, after you're really on your feet again, I may, like, re-examine my options.
He looks around and sighs deeply.
There may be a Disneyland or Coney Island somewhere in your world, Roland, but what I've seen of it so far really doesn't interest me much.
He starts away, pauses, and looks back again at Roland. His face is somber. Although some of the sickly pallor has left it, the shakes have become no more than occasional tremors.
Sometimes you really don't understand me, do you?
No, the gunslinger whispers. Sometimes I don't.
Then I'll elucidate. There are people who need people to need them. The reason you don't understand is because you're not one of those people. You'd use me and then toss me away like a paper bag if that's what it came down to. God fucked you, my friend. You're just smart enough so it would hurt you to do that, and just hard enough so you'd go ahead and do it anyway. You wouldn't be able to help yourself. If I was lying on the beach there and screaming for help, you'd walk over me if I was between you and your goddamn tower. Isn't that pretty close to the truth?
Roland says nothing, only watches Eddie.
But not everyone is like that. There are people who need people to need them, like the Barbra Streisand song. Corny, but true. It's just another way of being hooked through the bag.
Eddie gazes at him.
But when it comes to that, you're clean, aren't you?
Roland watches him.
Except for your tower.
Eddie utters a short laugh.
You're a tower junkie, Roland.
Which war was it? Roland whispers.
What?
The one where you got your sense of nobility and purpose shot off.
Eddie recoils as if Roland has reached out and slapped him.
I'm gonna go get some water, he says shortly. Keep an eye on the creepy crawlers. We came a long way today, but I still don't know if they talk to each other or not.
He turns away then, but not before Roland has seen the last red rays of sunset reflected on his wet cheeks.
Roland turns back to the beach and watches. The lobstrosities crawl and question and crawl, but both activities seem aimless. They have some intelligence, but not enough to pass on information to others of their kind. God doesn't always dish it in your face, Roland thinks. Most times, but not always. Eddie returns with wood. Well, he asks, what do you think?
We're all right, the gunslinger croaks.
And Eddie starts to say something, but the gunslinger is tired now, and lies back and looks at the first stars peeking through the canopy of violet sky and... shuffle. In the 3 days that followed, the gunslinger progressed steadily back to health. The red lines creeping up his arms first reversed their direction, then faded, then disappeared. On the next day, he sometimes walked and sometimes let Eddie drag him. On the day following, he didn't need to be dragged at all. Every hour or two, they simply sat for a period of time until the watery feeling went out of his legs. It was during these rests and in those times after dinner had been eaten, but before the fire had burned all the way down and they went to sleep, that the gunslinger heard about Henry and Eddie. He remembered wondering what had happened to make their brothering so difficult. But after Eddie had begun, haltingly and with that sort of resentful anger that proceeds from deep pain, the gunslinger could have stopped him, could have told him, "Don't bother, Eddie, I understand everything." Except that wouldn't have helped Eddie. Eddie wasn't talking to help Henry because Henry was dead. He was talking to bury Henry for good, and to remind himself that although Henry was dead, he, Eddie, wasn't. So the gunslinger listened and said nothing. The gist was simple. Eddie believed he had stolen his brother's life. Henry also believed this. Henry might have believed it on his own, or he might have believed it because he so frequently heard their mother lecturing Eddie on how much both she and Henry had sacrificed for him so Eddie could be as safe as anyone could be in this jungle of a city, so he could be happy as anyone could be in this jungle of a city, so he wouldn't end up like his poor sister that he didn't even hardly remember, but she had been so beautiful, God-lover, she was with the angels, and that was undoubtedly a wonderful place to be. But she didn't want Eddie to be with the angels just yet, run over in the road by some crazy drunken driver like his sister, or cut up by some crazy junkie kid for the 25 cents in his pocket and left with his guts running out all over the sidewalk. And because she didn't think Eddie wanted to be with the angels yet, he just better listen to what his big brother said and do what his big brother said to do, and always remember that Henry was making a love sacrifice. Eddie told the gunslinger he doubted if his mother knew some of the things they had done, filching comic books from the candy store on Rincon Avenue or smoking cigarettes behind the bonded electroplate factory on Coho Street. Once they saw a Chevrolet with the keys in it, and although Henry barely knew how to drive, he was 16 then, Eddie 8, he had crammed his brother into the car and said they were going to New York City. Eddie was scared, crying. Henry scared, too, and mad at Eddie, telling him to shut up, telling him to stop being such a fucking baby. He had 10 bucks, and Eddie had 3 or 4. They could go to the movies all fucking day, and then catch a Pelham train and be back before their mother had time to put supper on the table and wonder where they were. But Eddie kept crying, and near the Queensboro Bridge, they saw a police car on a side street. And although Eddie was pretty sure the cop in it hadn't even been looking their way, he said yeah when Eddie asked him in a harsh, quavering voice if Eddie thought that bull had seen them. Henry turned white and pulled over so fast that he had almost amputated a fire hydrant. He was running down the block while Eddie, now in a panic himself, was still struggling with the unfamiliar door handle. Henry stopped, came back, and hauled Eddie out of the car. He also slapped him twice. Then they had walked... well, actually, they slunk all the way back to Brooklyn. It took them most of the day, and when their mother asked them why they looked so hot and sweaty and tired out, Henry said it was because he'd spent most of the day teaching Eddie how to go one-on-one on the basketball court at the playground around the block. Then some big kids came, and they had to run. Their mother kissed Henry and beamed at Eddie. She asked him if he didn't have the bestest big brother in the world. Eddie agreed with her. This was honest agreement, too. He thought he did. He was as scared as I was that day, Eddie told Roland, as they sat and watched the last of the day dwindle from the water, where soon the only light would be that reflected from the stars. Scared her, really, because he thought that cop saw us, and I knew he didn't. That's why he ran. But he came back. That's the important part. He came back.
Roland said nothing.
You see that, don't you?
Eddie was looking at Roland with harsh, questioning eyes.
I see. He was always scared, but he always came back.
Roland thought it would have been better for Eddie, maybe better for both of them in the long run, if Henry had just kept showing his heels that day, or on one of the others.
But people like Henry never did. People like Henry always came back, because people like Henry knew how to use trust. It was the only thing people like Henry did know how to use. First they changed trust into need, then they changed need into a drug, and once that was done, they, what was Eddie's word for it?
Push.
Yes, they pushed it.
I think I'll turn in, the gunslinger said.
The next day Eddie went on, but Roland already knew it all. Henry hadn't played sports in high school because Henry couldn't stay after for practice. Henry had to take care of Eddie. The fact that Henry was scrawny and uncoordinated and didn't much care for sports in the first place had nothing to do with it, of course. Henry would have made a wonderful baseball pitcher, or one of those basketball jumpers, their mother assured them both time and again. Henry's grades were bad, and he needed to repeat a number of subjects, but that wasn't because Henry was stupid. Eddie and Mrs. Dean both knew Henry was just as smart as lickety-split. But Henry had to spend the time he should have spent studying or doing homework taking care of Eddie. The fact that this usually took place in the Dean living room, with both boys sprawled on the sofa watching TV or wrestling around on the floor, somehow seemed not to matter. The bad grades meant Henry hadn't been able to be accepted into anything but NYU. And they couldn't afford it, because the bad grades precluded any scholarships. And then Henry got drafted, and then it was Vietnam, where Henry got most of his knee blown off, and the pain was bad, and the drug they gave him for it had a heavy morphine base, and when he was better they weaned him from the drug, only they didn't do such a good job, because when Henry got back to New York there was still a monkey on his back, a hungry monkey waiting to be fed, and after a month or two he had gone out to see a man, and it had been about 4 months later, less than a month after their mother died, when Eddie first saw his brother snorting some white powder off a mirror. Eddie assumed it was coke. Turned out it was heroin. And if you traced it all the way back, whose fault was it? Roland said nothing, but heard the voice of Court in his mind. Fault always lies in the same place, my fine babies. With him weak enough to lay blame. When he discovered the truth, Eddie had been shocked. Then angry. Henry had responded not by promising to quit snorting, but by telling Eddie he didn't blame him for being mad. He knew Nam had turned him into a worthless shitbag. He was weak. He would leave. That was the best thing. Eddie was right. The last thing he needed was a filthy junkie around, messing up the place. He just hoped Eddie wouldn't blame him too much. He had gotten weak, he admitted it. Something in Nam had made him weak, had rotted him out the same way the moisture rotted the laces of your sneakers and the elastic of your underwear. There was also something in Nam that apparently rotted out your heart, Henry told him tearily. He just hoped that Eddie would remember all the years he had tried to be strong. For Eddie. For Mom. So Henry tried to leave. And Eddie, of course, couldn't let him. Eddie was consumed with guilt. Eddie had seen the scarred horror that had once been an unmarked leg, a leg that was now more Teflon than bone. They had a screaming match in the hall, Henry standing there in an old pair of khakis with his packed duffel bag in one hand and purple rings under his eyes, Eddie wearing nothing but a pair of yellowing jockey shorts, Henry saying, "You don't need me around, Eddie, I'm poison to you and I know it," and Eddie yelling back, "You ain't going nowhere, get your ass back inside," and that's how it went until Mrs. McGursky came out of her place and yelled, "Go or stay, it's nothing to me, but you better decide one way or the other pretty quick or I'm calling the police." Mrs. McGursky seemed about to add a few more admonishments, but just then she saw that Eddie was wearing nothing but a pair of skivvies. She added, "And you're not decent, Eddie Dean," before popping back inside. It was like watching a jack-in-the-box in reverse. Eddie looked at Henry. Henry looked at Eddie. Look like Angel Baby done put on a few pounds, Henry said in a low voice, and then they were howling with laughter, holding on to each other and pounding each other, and Henry came back inside, and about 2 weeks later Eddie was snorting the stuff too, and he couldn't understand why the hell he had made such a big deal out of it. After all, it was only snorting. Shit, it got you off. And as Henry, who Eddie would eventually come to think of as the great sage and eminent junkie, said, in a world that was clearly going to hell head first, what was so low about getting high? Time passed. Eddie didn't say how much. The gunslinger didn't ask. He guessed that Eddie knew there were 1,000 excuses for getting high, but no reasons, and that he had kept his habit pretty well under control. And that Henry had also managed to keep his under control, not as well as Eddie, but enough to keep him from coming completely unraveled. Because whether or not Eddie understood the truth, down deep Roland believed Eddie did, Henry must have. Their positions had reversed themselves. Now Eddie held Henry's hand crossing streets. The day came when Eddie caught Henry not snorting, but skin-popping. There had been another hysterical argument, an almost exact repeat of the first one, except it had been in Henry's bedroom. It ended in almost exactly the same way, with Henry weeping and offering that implacable, inarguable defense that was utter surrender, utter admission. Eddie was right. He wasn't fit to live, not fit to eat garbage from the gutter. He would go. Eddie would never have to see him again. He just hoped he would remember all that. It faded into a drone that wasn't much different from the rocky sound of the breaking waves as they trudged up the beach. Roland knew the story and said nothing. It was Eddie who didn't know the story, and Eddie who was really clear-headed for the first time in maybe 10 years or more. Eddie wasn't telling the story to Roland. Eddie was finally telling the story to himself. That was all right. So far as the gunslinger could see, time was something they had a lot of. Talk was one way to fill it. Eddie said he was haunted by Henry's knee, the twisted scar tissue up and down his leg. Of course, that was all healed now. Henry barely even limped, except when he and Eddie were quarreling. Then the limp always seemed to get worse. He was haunted by all the things Henry had given up for him, and haunted by something much more pragmatic. Henry wouldn't last out on the streets. He would be like a rabbit let loose in a jungle filled with tigers. On his own, Henry would wind up in jail or Bellevue before a week was out. So he begged, and Henry finally did him the favor of consenting to stick around, and 6 months after that, Eddie also had a golden arm. From that moment, things had begun to move in the steady and inevitable downward spiral, which had ended with Eddie's trip to the Bahamas and Roland's sudden intervention in his life. Another man, less pragmatic and more introspective than Roland, might have asked, to himself if not right out loud, why this one? Why this man to start? Why a man who seems to promise weakness or strangeness or even outright doom? Not only did the gunslinger never ask the question, it never even formulated itself in his mind. Cuthbert would have asked. Cuthbert had questioned everything, had been poisoned with questions, had died with one in his mouth. Now they were gone. All gone. Court's last gunslingers, the 13 survivors of a beginning class that had numbered 56, were all dead. All dead but Roland. He was the last gunslinger, going steadily on in a world that had grown stale and sterile and empty. 13, he remembered Court saying on the day before the presentation ceremonies. This is an evil number. And on the following day, for the first time in 30 years, Court had not been present at the ceremonies. His final crop of pupils had gone to his cottage, to first kneel at his feet, presenting defenseless necks, then to rise and receive his congratulatory kiss, and to allow him to load their guns for the first time. 9 weeks later, Court was dead. Of poison, some said. 2 years after his death, the final bloody civil war had begun. The red slaughter had reached the last bastion of civilization, light, and sanity, and had taken away what all of them had assumed was so strong with the casual ease of a wave taking a child's castle of sand. So he was the last, and perhaps he had survived because the dark romance in his nature was overset by his practicality and simplicity. He understood that only three things mattered: mortality, Ka, and the tower. Those were enough things to think about. Eddie finished his tale around 4 o'clock on the third day of their northward journey up the featureless beach. The beach itself never seemed to change. If a sign of progress was wanted, it could only be obtained by looking left, to the east. There the jagged peaks of the mountains had begun to soften and slump a bit. It was possible that if they went north far enough, the mountains would become rolling hills. With his story told, Eddie lapsed into silence, and they walked without speaking for a half an hour or longer. Eddie kept stealing little glances at him. Roland knew Eddie wasn't aware that he was picking these glances up. He was still too much in himself. Roland also knew what Eddie was waiting for, a response, some kind of response, any kind. Twice Eddie opened his mouth, only to close it again. Finally he asked what the gunslinger had known he would ask.
"So? What do you think?"
"I think you're here." Eddie stopped, fisted hands planted on his hips.
"That's all? That's it?"
"That's all I know," the gunslinger replied. His missing fingers and toe throbbed and itched. He wished for some more of the Astin from Eddie's world.
"You don't have any opinion on what the hell it all means?"
The gunslinger might have held up his subtracted right hand and said, "Think about what this means, you silly idiot," but it no more crossed his mind to say this than it had to ask why it was Eddie, out of all the people in all the universes that might exist. "It's Ka," he said, facing Eddie patiently.
"What's Ka?"
Eddie's voice was truculent.
"I never heard of it. Except if you say it twice, you come out with the baby word for shit."
"I don't know about that," the gunslinger said. "Here it means duty or destiny, or, in the Vulgate, a place you must go." Eddie managed to look dismayed, disgusted, and amused all at the same time.
"Then say it twice, Roland, because words like that sound like shit to this kid."
The gunslinger shrugged. "I don't discuss philosophy. I don't study history. All I know is what's past is past, and what's ahead is ahead. The second is Ka, and takes care of itself."
"Yeah?"
Eddie looked northward.
"Well, all I see ahead is about 9 billion miles of this same fucking beach. If that's what's ahead, Ka and Kaka are the same thing. We might have enough good shells to pop 5 or 6 more of those lobster dudes, but then we're going to be down to chucking rocks at them. So where are we going?"
Roland did wonder briefly if this was a question Eddie had ever thought to ask his brother. But to ask such a question would only be an invitation to a lot of meaningless argument. So he only cocked a thumb northward and said, "There, to begin with." Eddie looked, and saw nothing but the same reach of shell and rock-studded gray shingle. He looked back at Roland, about to scoff, saw the serene certainty on his face, and looked again. He squinted. He shielded the right side of his face from the westering sun with his right hand. He wanted desperately to see something, anything, shit even a mirage would do. But there was nothing.
"Crap on me all you want to," Eddie said slowly. "But I say it's a goddamn mean trick. I put my life on the line for you at Balazar's."
"I know you did." The gunslinger smiled, a rarity that lit his face like a momentary flash of sunlight on a dismal, lowering day. "That's why I've done nothing but square deal you, Eddie. It's there. I saw it an hour ago. At first I thought it was only a mirage or wishful thinking, but it's there, all right." Eddie looked again, looked until water ran from the corners of his eyes. At last he said, "I don't see anything up ahead but more beach, and I got 20/20 vision."
"I don't know what that means."
"It means if there was something there to see, I'd see it."
But Eddie wondered. Wondered how much further than his own the gunslinger's blue bullshooter's eyes could see. Maybe a little. Maybe a lot.
"You'll see it," the gunslinger said.
"See what?"
"We won't get there today. But if you see as well as you say, you'll see it before the sun hits the water. Unless you just want to stand here chin-jawing, that is."
"Caw," Eddie said in a musing voice. Roland nodded.
"Caw."
"Caw-caw," Eddie said, and laughed. "Come on, Roland, let's take a hike. And if I don't see anything by the time the sun hits the water, you owe me a chicken dinner. Or a Big Mac, or anything that isn't lobster."
"Come on." They started walking again, and it was at least a full hour before the sun's lower arc touched the horizon when Eddie Dean began to see the shape in the distance. Vague, shimmering, indefinable, but definitely something. Something new.
"Okay," he said. "I see it. You must have eyes like Superman."
"Who?"
"Never mind. You've got a really incredible case of culture lag, you know it?"
"What?"
Eddie laughed.
"Never mind. What is it?"
"You'll see." The gunslinger started walking again before Eddie could ask anything else. 20 minutes later, Eddie thought he did see. 15 minutes after that, he was sure. The object on the beach was still 2, maybe 3 miles away, but he knew what it was. A door, of course. Another door. Neither of them slept well that night, and they were up and walking an hour before the sun cleared the eroding shapes of the mountains. They reached the door just as the morning sun's first rays, so sublime and so still, broke over them. Those rays lighted their stubbly cheeks like lamps. They made the gunslinger 40 again, and Eddie no older than Roland had been when he went out to fight court with his hawk David as his weapon. This door was exactly like the first, except for what was writ upon it. The Lady of Shadows.
"So," Eddie said softly, looking at the door which simply stood here with its hinges grounded in some unknown jam between one world and another, one universe and another. It stood with its graven message, real as rock and strange as starlight.
"So," the gunslinger agreed.
"Ka.
Ka.
Here is where you draw a second of your three?"
"It seems so."
The gunslinger knew what was in Eddie's mind before Eddie knew it himself. He saw Eddie make his move before Eddie knew he was moving. He could have turned and broken Eddie's arm in 2 places before Eddie knew it was happening, but he made no move. He let Eddie snake the revolver from his right holster. It was the first time in his life he had allowed one of his weapons to be taken from him without an offer of that weapon having first been made. Yet he made no move to stop it. He turned and looked at Eddie equably, even mildly. Eddie's face was livid, strained. His eyes showed starry whites all the way around the irises. He held the heavy revolver in both hands, and still the muzzle rambled from side to side, centering, moving off, centering again, and then moving off again.
"Open it," he said.
"You're being foolish," the gunslinger said in the same mild voice. "Neither of us has any idea where that door goes. It needn't open on your universe, let alone upon your world. For all either of us know, the Lady of Shadows might have 8 eyes and 9 arms, like Suvia. Even if it does open on your world, it might be on a time long before you were born or long after you would have died." Eddie smiled tightly.
"Tell you what, Monty, I'm more than willing to trade the rubber chicken and the shitty seaside vacation for what's behind door number 2.
"I don't understand."
"Yeah, I know you don't. It doesn't matter. Just open the fucker."
The gunslinger shook his head. They stood in the dawn, the door casting its slanted shadow toward the ebbing sea.
"Open it!" Eddie cried. "I'm going with you. Don't you get it? I'm going with you. That doesn't mean I won't come back. Maybe I will. I mean, probably I will. I guess I owe you that much. You've been square jawn with me down the line. Don't think I'm not aware of the fact. But while you get whoever this shadow baby is, I'm going to find the nearest Chicken Delight and pick me up some takeout. I think the 30-piece family pack should do for starters."
"You stay here."
"You think I don't mean it?"
Eddie was shrill now, close to the edge. The gunslinger could almost see him, looking down into the drifty depths of his own damnation. Eddie thumbed back the revolver's ancient hammer. The wind had fallen with the break of the day and the ebb of the tide, and the click of the hammer as Eddie brought it to full cock was very clear.
"You just try me!"
"I think I will," the gunslinger said.
"I'll shoot you!"
Eddie screamed. "Ka," the gunslinger replied stolidly, and turned to the door. He was reaching for the knob, but his heart was waiting, waiting to see if he would live or die. Ka. The Lady of Shadows. Chapter 1. Detta and Odetta. Stripped of jargon, what Adler said was this. The perfect schizophrenic, if there was such a person, would be a man or woman not only unaware of his other personae, but one unaware that anything at all was amiss in his or her life. Adler should have met Detta Walker and Odetta Holmes. 1. "Last gunslinger," Andrew said. He had been talking for quite a while, but Andrew always talked, and Odetta usually just let it flow over her mind, the way you let warm water flow over your hair and face in the shower. But this did more than catch her attention. It snagged it, as if on a thorn. "I beg pardon?"
"Oh, it's just some column in the paper," Andrew said. "I don't know who wrote it. I didn't notice. One of those political fellows. Probably you'd know him as Holmes. I loved him, and I cried the night he was elected."
She smiled, touched in spite of herself. Andrew said his ceaseless chatter was something he couldn't stop, wasn't responsible for, that it was just the Irish in him coming out. And most of it was nothing, cluckings and chirrupings about relatives and friends she would never meet, half-baked political opinions, weird scientific commentary gleaned from any number of weird sources. Among other things, Andrew was a firm believer in flying saucers, which he called UFOs. But this touched her, because she had also cried the night he was elected.
"But I didn't cry when that son of a bitch—pardon my French, Miss Holmes—when that son of a bitch Oswald shot him. And I hadn't cried since. And it's been, what, 2 months?"
3 months and 2 days," she thought. "Something like that, I guess." Andrew nodded.
"Then I read this column, in the Daily News it might have been, yesterday, about how Johnson's probably going to do a pretty good job, but it won't be the same. The guy said America had seen the passage of the world's last gunslinger." "I don't think John Kennedy was that at all," Odetta said.
And if her voice was sharper than the one Andrew was accustomed to hearing, which it must have been because she saw his eyes give a startled blink in the rearview mirror, a blink that was more like a wince, it was because she felt herself touched by this, too. It was absurd, but it was also a fact. There was something about that phrase, "America has seen the passage of the world's last gunslinger," that rang deeply in her mind. It was ugly, it was untrue. John Kennedy had been a peacemaker, not a leather-slapping Billy the Kid type. That was more on the Goldwater line. But it had also, for some reason, given her goosebumps.
"Well, the guy said there would be no shortage of shooters in the world," Andrew went on, regarding her nervously in the rearview mirror. "He mentioned Jack Ruby, for one, and Castro, and this fellow in Haiti."
"Duvalier," she said, "Papa Doc."
"Yeah, him. And Diem."
"The Diem brothers are dead."
"Well, he said Jack Kennedy was different, that's all. He said he would draw, but only if someone weaker needed him to draw, and only if there was nothing else to do.
He said Kennedy was savvy enough to know that sometimes talking don't do no good. He said Kennedy knew if it's foaming at the mouth, you have to shoot it.
His eyes continued to regard her apprehensively.
Besides, it was just some column I read.
The limo was gliding up Fifth Avenue now, headed toward Central Park West, the Cadillac emblem on the end of the hood cutting the frigid February air.
Yes, Odetta said mildly, and Andrew's eyes relaxed a trifle.
I understand. I don't agree, but I understand.
You are a liar,
a voice spoke up in her mind. This was a voice she heard quite often. She'd even named it. It was the voice of the goad.
You understand perfectly and agree completely. Lie to Andrew if you feel it necessary, but for God's sake, don't lie to yourself, woman.
Yet part of her protested, horrified. In a world which had become a nuclear powder keg, upon which nearly a billion people now sat, it was a mistake, perhaps one of suicidal proportions, to believe there was a difference between good shooters and bad shooters. There were too many shaky hands holding lighters near too many fuses. This was no world for gunslingers. If there had ever been a time for them, it had passed. Hadn't it? She closed her eyes briefly and rubbed at her temples. She could feel one of her headaches coming on. Sometimes they threatened like an ominous build-up of thunderheads on a hot summer afternoon, and then blew away, as those ugly summer brews sometimes simply slipped away in one direction or another to stomp their thunders and lightnings into the ground of some other place. She thought, however, that this time the storm was going to happen. It would come complete with thunder, lightning, and hail the size of golf balls. The streetlights marching up Fifth Avenue seemed much too bright.
"So, how was Oxford, Miss Holmes?" Andrew asked tentatively.
"Humid. February or not, it was very humid."
She paused, telling herself she wouldn't say the words that were crowding up her throat like bile, that she would swallow them back down. To say them would be needlessly brutal. Andrew's talk of the world's last gunslinger had been just more of the man's endless prattling. But on top of everything else, it was just a bit too much, and it came out anyway, what she had no business saying. Her voice sounded as calm and as resolute as ever, she supposed, but she was not fooled. She knew a blurt when she heard one.
The bail bondsman came very promptly, of course. He had been notified in advance. They held on to us as long as they could, nevertheless, and I held on as long as I could, but I guess they won that one because I ended up wetting myself.
She saw Andrew's eyes wince away again, and she wanted to stop and couldn't stop.
It's what they want to teach you, you see. Partly because it frightens you, I suppose, and a frightened person may not come down to their precious Southland and bother them again. But I think most of them, even the dumb ones, and they are by all means not all dumb, know the change will come in the end no matter what they do, and so they take the chance to degrade you while they still can. To teach you you can be degraded. You can swear before God, Christ, and the whole company of saints that you will not soil yourself. But if they hold on to you long enough, of course you do. The lesson is that you're just an animal in a cage. No more than that, no better than that. Just an animal in a cage. So I wet myself. I can still smell dried urine in that damned holding cell. They think we are descended from the monkeys, you know. And that's exactly what I smell like to myself right now. A monkey.
She saw Andrew's eyes in the rearview mirror and was sorry for the way his eyes looked. Sometimes your urine wasn't the only thing you couldn't hold.
I'm sorry, Miss Holmes.
No, she said, rubbing at her temples again. I am the one who is sorry. It's been a trying 3 days, Andrew.
I should think so, he said in a shocked, old maidish voice that made her laugh in spite of herself.
But most of her wasn't laughing. She thought she had known what she was getting into, that she had fully anticipated how bad it could get. She had been wrong. A trying 3 days, well, that was one way to put it. Another might be that her 3 days in Oxford, Mississippi, had been a short season in hell. But there were some things you couldn't say, some things you would die before saying.
unless you were called upon to testify to them before the throne of God the Father Almighty, where, she supposed, even the truths that caused the hellish thunderstorms and that strange gray jelly between your ears, the scientist said that gray jelly was nerveless, and if that wasn't a hoot and a half, she didn't know what was, must be admitted. I just want to get home and bathe, 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 and sleep, sleep, sleep. Then I reckon I will be as right as rain.
Why, sure. That's just what you're going to be.
Andrew wanted to apologize for something, and this was as close as he could come. And beyond this, he didn't want to risk further conversation. So the two of them rode in unaccustomed silence to the gray Victorian block of apartments on the corner of Fifth and Central Park South. A very exclusive gray Victorian block of apartments, and she supposed that made her a blockbuster. And she knew there were people in those poshy, poshy flats who would not speak to her unless they absolutely had to, and she didn't really care. Besides, she was above them, and they knew she was above them. It had occurred to her on more than one occasion that it must have galled some of them mightily, knowing there was a nigger living in the penthouse apartment of this fine, staid old building, where once the only black hands allowed had been clad in white gloves, or perhaps the thin black leather ones of a chauffeur. She hoped it did gall them mightily, and scolded herself for being mean, for being unchristian. But she did wish it. She hadn't been able to stop the piss pouring into the crotch of her fine silk imported underwear, and she didn't seem to be able to stop this other flood of piss either. It was mean, it was unchristian, and almost as bad. No, worse, at least as far as the movement was concerned. It was counterproductive. They were going to win the rights they needed to win, and probably this year. Johnson, mindful of the legacy which had been left him by the slain president, and perhaps hoping to put another nail in the coffin of Barry Goldwater, would do more than oversee the passage of the Civil Rights Act. If necessary, he would ram it into law. So it was important to minimize the scarring and the hurt. There was more work to be done. Hate would not help do that work. Hate would, in fact, hinder it. But sometimes you went on hating just the same. Oxford Town had taught her that, too. 2. Detta Walker had absolutely no interest in the movement and much more modest digs. She lived in the loft of a peeling Greenwich Village apartment building. Odetta didn't know about the loft, and Detta didn't know about the penthouse, and the only one left who suspected something was not quite right was Andrew Feeney, the chauffeur. He had begun working for Odetta's father when Odetta was 14, and Detta Walker hardly existed at all. Sometimes Odetta disappeared. These disappearances might be a matter of hours or of days. Last summer she had disappeared for 3 weeks, and Andrew had been ready to call the police when Odetta called him one evening and asked him to bring the car around at 10 the next day. She planned to do some shopping, she said. It trembled on his lips to cry out, "Miss Holmes, where have you been?" But he had asked this before, and had received only puzzled stares, truly puzzled stares, he was sure, in return. "Right here," she would say. "Why, right here, Andrew. You've been driving me 2 or 3 places every day, haven't you? You aren't starting to go a little mushy in the head, are you?" Then she would laugh, and if she was feeling especially good, as she often seemed to feel after her disappearances, she would pinch his cheek. "Very good, Miss Holmes," he had said. 10 it is." That scary time she had been gone for 3 weeks, Andrew had put down the phone, closed his eyes, and said a quick prayer to the Blessed Virgin for Miss Holmes' safe return. Then he had rung Howard, the doorman at her building. "What time did she come in?" "Just about 20 minutes ago," Howard said.
"Who brought her?"
"Dunno. You know how it is, different car every time. Sometimes they park around the block and I don't see 'em at all. Don't even know she's back until I hear the buzzer and look out and see it's her." Howard paused, then added, "She's got one hell of a bruise on her cheek." Howard had been right. It sure had been one hell of a bruise, and now it was getting better. Andrew didn't like to think what it might have looked like when it was fresh. Miss Holmes appeared promptly at 10 the next morning, wearing a silk sundress with spaghetti-thin straps. This had been late July, and by then the bruise had started to yellow. She had made only a perfunctory effort to cover it with makeup, as if knowing that too much effort to cover it would only draw further attention to it.
"How did you get that, Miss Holmes?" he asked.
She laughed merrily. "You know me, Andrew, clumsy as ever. My hand slipped on the grab handle while I was getting out of the tub yesterday. I was in a hurry to catch the national news. I fell and banged the side of my face."
She gauged his face.
"You're getting ready to stop blithering about doctors and examinations, aren't you? Don't bother answering. After all these years, I can read you like a book. I won't go, so you needn't bother asking. I'm just as fine as paint. Onward, Andrew. I intend to buy half a Saks, all the Gimbals, and eat everything at Four Seasons in between."
"Yes, Miss Holmes," he had said, and smiled.
It was a forced smile, and forcing it was not easy. That bruise wasn't a day old, it was a week old at least, and he knew better anyway, didn't he? He had called her every night at 7 o'clock for the last week, because if there was one time when you could catch Miss Holmes in her place, it was when the Huntley-Brinkley report came on. A regular junkie for her news was Miss Holmes. He had done it every night, that was, except last night. Then he had gone over and wheedled the passkey from Howard. A conviction had been growing on him steadily that she had had just the sort of accident she described, only instead of getting a bruise or a broken bone, she had died. Died alone, and was lying up there dead right now. He had let himself in, heart thumping, feeling like a cat in a dark room crisscrossed with piano wires, only there had been nothing to be nervous about. There was a butter dish on the kitchen counter, and although the butter had been covered, it had been out long enough to be growing a good crop of mold. He got there at 7:10 and had left by 5 after. In the course of his quick examination of the apartment, he had glanced into the bathroom. The tub had been dry, the towels neatly, even austerely arrayed, the room's many grab handles polished to a bright steel gleam that was unspotted with water. He knew the accident she had described had not happened. But Andrew had not believed she was lying, either. She had believed what she had told him. He looked in the rearview mirror again and saw her rubbing her temples lightly with the tips of her fingers. He didn't like it. He had seen her do that too many times before one of her disappearances. 3. Andrew left the motor running so she could have the benefit of the heater, then went around to the trunk. He looked at her 2 suitcases with another wince. They looked as if petulant men with small minds and large bodies had kicked them relentlessly back and forth, damaging the bags in a way they did not quite dare damage Miss Holmes herself, the way they might have damaged him, for instance, if he had been there. It wasn't just that she was a woman. She was a nigger, an uppity northern nigger, messing where she had no business messing, and they probably figured a woman like that deserved just what she got. Thing was, she was also a rich nigger. Thing was, she was almost as well known to the American public as Medgar Evers or Martin Luther King. Thing was, she'd gotten her rich nigger face on the cover of Time magazine, and it was a little harder to get away with sticking someone like that in the toolies and then saying, "What? No, sir, boss. We shouldn't see nobody look like that down here, did we, boys?" Thing was, it was a little harder to work yourself up to hurting a woman who was the only heir to Holmes Dental Industries when there were 12 Holmes plants in the sunny South, one of them just 1 county over from Oxford Town, Oxford Town. So they'd done to her suitcases what they didn't dare do to her. He looked at these mute indications of her stay in Oxford Town with shame and fury and love. Emotions as mute as the scars on the luggage that had gone away looking smart and had come back looking dumb and thumped. He looked, temporarily unable to move, and his breath puffed out on the frosty air. Howard was coming out to help, but Andrew paused a moment longer before grasping the handles of the cases.
"Who are you, Miss Holmes? Who are you really? Where do you go sometimes, and what do you do that seems so bad that you have to make up a false history of the missing hours or days, even to yourself?"
And he thought something else in the moment before Howard arrived, something weirdly apt.
"Where's the rest of you?"
"You'll want to quit thinking like that. If anyone around here was going to do any thinking like that, it would be Miss Holmes, but she doesn't, and so you don't need to either." Andrew lifted the bags out of the trunk and handed them to Howard, who asked in a low voice, "Is she all right?"
"I think so,"
Andrew replied, also pitching his voice low. Just tired is all. Tired all the way down to her roots. Howard nodded, took the battered suitcases, and started back inside. He paused only long enough to tip his cap to Odetta Holmes, who was almost invisible behind the smoked glass windows, in a soft and respectful salute. When he was gone, Andrew took out the collapsed stainless steel scaffolding at the bottom of the trunk and began to unfold it. It was a wheelchair. Since August 19, 1959, some 5.5 years before, the part of Odetta Holmes from the knees down had been as missing as those blank hours and days.